Georgia's DBHDD is warning all Georgians that half of all opioid deaths happen at home, when people take an Oxy or a Perc with a glass of alcohol for stress or to sleep. Learn more about protecting families from opioid overdoses at opioidresponse.info.
Thanks for listening to the Political Rewind podcast. Be sure to like and follow us and rate us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. You know, these days in Georgia, it seems like often we have more that separates us from one another. Certainly in politics, that's been true. But I'll tell you one thing that unites all of us. There is a line of storms coming across the state that extends from the northern border with Tennessee all the way down through Atlanta, Macon, Albany, and all the way across the state. And it's just going to get more and more intense, it appears, as the day goes by. So I hope you'll pay attention to weather forecasts and that you'll all be safe and sound as we get some stormy weather today. We have so much to talk about on this Friday. It's been a consequential week in national and state politics, so let's get right to it. Jim Galloway is my partner on the Friday show. You know Jim as the former political columnist for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution and longtime analyst of Georgia politics. Jim, how are you today?
I'm doing very, very well. I'm just kind of looking at a dark sky and hoping I can stay online here.
You'll be fine. We're going to make sure nothing happens to your connection to us. We're also joined by Chuck Williams, reporter for WRBL-TV in Columbus, a longtime print reporter down there, made the switch to television in an interesting way at a point in his career when most people just kind of finish out what they're doing. He's had a long and illustrious career covering politics and other news down there. Chuck, how long have you been at WRBL doing TV now?
3.5 years, and I have a new favorite term. Today, we're right in the middle of it. Weather aware. We are weather aware at WRBL today.
Okay. Thank you, Chuck. Amy Steigerwalt is back with us, a political science professor and associate chair of the political science department at Georgia State. Amy, for today's show, since the abortion ruling or the draft opinion became such a huge story on Monday, and we'll talk about the consequences of it in politics today, we should also point out that you've written and researched extensively on the federal courts. And you actually authored a book, and I'm not sure how many years ago it was. It's Judging Law and Policy, Courts and Policymaking in the American Political System, in which you raise questions about the extent to which courts do make social and public policy changes and have influence on public policy. So I'm really happy you're with us today.
Well, thank you very much. I'm excited to be here. My son challenged me to say smart things, so we'll see if I can follow through.
Okay, I think you might succeed. And Rafael Olivaria is with us. He's a reporter for Univision, focusing mainly now on politics and immigration. Rafael, this is the time to be moving your beat as close to politics as you can. Thanks for being here.
I'm happy to be here, Bill. Happy to be with you guys. And yes, when I first began with Univision, I had little to no idea how important Georgia was going to become. So yeah, this is the moment right now.
You're a native of Venezuela, right?
I am. I've been in Georgia for about 8 years. And, you know, it's been interesting having, you know, my experience from back in Venezuela and now see the political developments here. So it's been a really interesting moment and experience to see all of this.
Well, we're happy that you could be with us today. I do want to start. I want to get into the abortion discussion in just a minute because it's important, obviously. But, Jim, let's take a look very quickly at the first week of early voting, which started, of course, on Monday. It's been fascinating to watch. We now have 4 days of totals on early voting. And so far, 132,000 people have voted. If you compare that to the same time 4 years ago, The number was only 42,000, 216% higher this year than 4 years ago. There's a huge appetite, apparently, for people to get out and vote. We'll see if it continues throughout the early voting period, of course.
Right, and this is without the this is without the abundance of drop boxes and such that were there in the last cycle. I do believe, and I'm looking at the website, this is it appears that we're headed back toward the more traditional population of absentee balloters, because you have down 62%. Are above the age of 65 and older. That includes me and my wife, by the way. We cast ours a couple days ago. But that's it's overwhelmingly white and Republican ballots that are being cast right now, and that goes to the point that the Democrats really their top issue, the gubernatorial race, has pretty much has already been settled with Stacey Abrams.
Yeah, Chuck, right now 58% of the early voters are Republican, 42% are Democrats. But as Jim points out, Chuck, you've got two contested races at the top of that Republican ballot. You've got the Senate race, Herschel Walker way out front there, but probably more importantly, the Perdue-Kemp gubernatorial contest, Chuck. Here's my question, and it's speculative, of course. If you're a down-ballot Democrat running in a contest for attorney general like a Jen Jordan, Secretary of State, like a B. Wynn and others, what kind of impact could it have on your ability to turn out voters if the top of the ballot is not attracting much attention?
A lot of impact, and I think you're starting to see that and see it in a real way. And, Muskogee County is a traditionally Democratic county. If you look right now, talk to our director of elections, the votes are coming from other parts of Georgia. Our vote totals are down right now, but it's 3-1 Democratic ballots over Republican, 27,2800 had voted in the first 4 days of early voting. But, if you are in that Secretary of State's race, or you're in that AG's race, or you're in that Lieutenant Governor's race that's contested, you've got to be wondering a little bit sort of what this looks like, because I'll even go a step further, Bill. How does it impact mayor's races in places like Columbus? Because let's go further down that ballot. We've got mayor, city council, and school board races going on down here. So I'm trying to kind of figure or understand all that from my reporting, and I think time will tell, but we've got to watch it very closely over the next 2 weeks, and then obviously on the 24th.
Raphael, when you look at the Hispanic community at this stage in the early voting, anecdotally, what kind of interest do you see in people getting out to the polls?
Usually what I've seen is mostly Latino activists trying to incentivize people to get out to the vote. And according to what I've seen, that the numbers you've seen is about 0.9% of the Hispanic population who's already voted. And I believe, and there's been a huge effort by many Hispanic groups to let the Hispanic voters first to try to sign up more Hispanics so they would be able to vote, because there are so many that are unregistered yet that are citizens. But at the same time is, to let them know how important the vote is. And I've seen them even with the last mayoral race, how they were out there trying to get out the vote. So I believe that's the effort that probably it's ongoing right now. But as Chuck was mentioning, many of these groups that are trying to get out the Hispanic vote, most of the time they are more connected to the Democratic Party or the Democratic candidates. And usually you don't see those groups really aligning with the Republican primaries. So I expect that probably the numbers that we're seeing right now when it comes to a general election might be higher than it is right now, but yes, certainly it's not the a number as high as many of these activists would like to be, because they want the Hispanic community to be heard, to be included in those debates, and sometimes they don't participate that much.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that it's been a little harder to really, really build momentum to get Hispanic voters out to the polls here in Georgia particularly, and that's an ongoing effort. Amy, what do you make of the early voting numbers?
They match up to what we've seen in the past. I mean, I think one of the things that people have to remember is that we're right now talking not about the general election, but the primary election. So primary elections turn out your base. They turn out the people who are attached to a particular party. You are, right, and within Georgia, what is sort of distinct is that you have to request which ballot you want. But you still, right, are not going to have sort of your independent, because partly they're being forced to choose, do they want to vote in the Republican primary? Do they want to vote in the Democratic primary? And so you're much more likely to see those who, number one, voting is a habit for them as opposed to an afterthought, those who are much more invested in the races and also much more invested in what's going on in their party. And so it's a very different population than votes in the general election. And I think we in part see that by where these breakdowns are coming in. So it is much more likely to be older. It's much more likely to be white. It's much more likely to be affluent. And that's what we're going to see in the primaries as opposed to in the general election.
Yeah, Bill, one thing I am saying, and I don't have any statistics for this, is just an anecdotal kind of sampling. I'm seeing a lot of independents and Democrats telling me that, well, telling the world that they're picking up a Republican ballot specifically because there are tighter races there, but also specifically because of Brad Raffensperger. Mm-hmm. They want to vote in that Secretary of State's race to support Raffensperger, who they think did the right thing last December in rebuffing Donald Trump's request to recount the vote to find his 11,000 votes, and against Jody Heiss, who Trump has endorsed.
Chuck,
you know, Bill, what Jim just said, I'm hearing the same thing down here. Five times yesterday, I had people I would consider traditional Democrats tell me they were voting Republican. I'm like, what for? They said, we're voting for Raffensperger. And, you know, I find it fascinating on this level. Usually when a Democrat pulls a Republican ballot or vice versa, they're trying to set up the weakest candidate for their person in the general. This is where they're saying this guy did the right thing and he needs to be rewarded with my ballot, and to the extent I'm not going to vote in the Calvin Smyre House race or whatever. It's interesting. They're going in that direction, and it's a reward for what they consider somebody that did the right thing. And, you know, it's really interesting, and I'm not sure the Republicans fully understand the size of that little bitty ripple wave that's coming out.
You know what's interesting about all this, Amy, before we move on, is that typically when the people of one party say they're going to cross over and vote in the other party, it's as Chuck says, they say they're going to do it to pick the weaker candidate in the other party for the general election. That typically, I think the studies show, they don't really do that. They say they're going to, but then they don't. But what's interesting about this is that you're talking about this positive decision to reward a candidate, and maybe that's something that really will happen in a way that the negative votes usually don't develop.
No, I think that's very true, and I mean, I've heard this, similar things from people, because I think that there is sort of a recognition that statewide Republican candidates are more likely to win. And so we'll have to see what happens in this election, but also the fact that there is a real concern about, from those who are supporting Raffensperger, about the idea of Jody Heiss being the Secretary of State candidate and the implications of that. Now, the flip side is I've also heard some people suggesting that they're voting for Raffensperger, but that they're also on that ballot, perhaps voting, for example, for Purdue because they want to try to force the runoff. And in that sense, make it more difficult because they, of course, get to, once you pick that ballot, that's the only ballot you get to pick that you get to vote on. Right. We don't have the ability to sort of pick and choose between the various races. But how many people are actually doing that and following through on it is going to be an interesting question. And it'll be interesting to see sort of where that turns out. And I think the other question is, right, we're again getting this question that we've been discussing for a very long time of how much impact are Trump's endorsements in these races going to have once all of the votes are in and counted.
All right. We will certainly keep track of early voting in the next couple of weeks and talk about how we're seeing it all shape up. But Jim, let's move into this whole issue of the Alito leak and the extraordinary impact it has had on our political, cultural, social landscape already, even though we know that there could be changes, certainly in the draft of the opinion, in the language. And for all we know, there could be some votes that change before it's finalized. That doesn't seem likely in terms of voting on it, but, you know, we have to always make that clear. Okay, so with all that in mind, we now know that Chuck Schumer is going to call for a vote next week on a measure that would enshrine the right to choice in federal law. We know that he has no chance of passing this, because he needs a supermajority to do it. No Republican will support it. For that matter, you've got a Democrat like Joe Manchin who is pro-life and won't support it. But it's an important symbolic move. Raphael Warnock, in what's expected to be a hotly contested re-election campaign, has already said not only would he vote for a federal law protecting the right to choice, but he would vote to overturn the filibuster so that it could be done on the basis of a simple majority.
Right, right. The vote, the Senate vote, is scheduled for Wednesday, and it's unlikely to clear even a simple majority. I mean, this morning Susan Collins said she's not going to be voting for it. Joe Manchin said that yesterday. So I don't know that it can reach the 50% threshold that would bring Vice President Kamala Harris into the mix here. We're in very, very uncharted territory here. I think this is not 1972. You have a sector of the population, and I'm speaking specifically of women, who are far more mobilized, who are far more active, who have networks that are financially supported. Stacey Abrams moved to discontinue her campaign funding and shift all that fundraising toward pro-abortion groups, pro-choice groups. I think that's indicative of it. I think you're going to see Republicans have to wrestle with this as well on two fronts. Number one, even though this is something they've pursued since the mid-80s, number one is, of course, the consequences. I think David Perdue was quoted this week as saying that he wants to make Georgia the safest place for the unborn. Well, if you're banning abortion, then I think the question shifts to, okay, what are you doing for those who are born, not the unborn, and that's going to put some weight on Republicans as far as maternal care goes, as far as child care goes. Then I think you have the question of enforcement. How do you police this? If you're going to criminalize abortion, how do you police it? And who is if every crime needs a criminal, you know? Who's the criminal? Is it the mother? Is it the doctor? Is it the anesthetist? Those are all questions that haven't been answered.
Well, in fact, the state of Louisiana yesterday passed out of committee a bill that would classify abortion as homicide and make it possible for prosecutors to bring criminal cases against women who end a pregnancy. Now, we don't know if it'll pass the whole legislature and with whether it'll be signed into law, but they're moving in that direction. Raphael, what's interesting about abortion rising to the front as the major issue in this election cycle is it fits into where Stacey Abrams was already headed. I mean, Abrams has made it clear that she is going to be laser focused on access to health care, on equality in health care, Medicaid expansion and the like for Georgians. That's her big issue. And so to add to that now, to be able to say the right to choice is a crucial part of that, really plays right into her strong suit.
And it's interesting, Bill, how this is starting to shape as a one-issue election, right? So you wouldn't have in all of these proposals because I'm fighting for this and that, but then you will have a one-issue election. And I believe it's going to be interesting the impact that we might see on Latino voters. You know, Democrats sometimes they try to reach out to Latino voters, but sometimes the way that they're reaching out has backfired a little bit. Sometimes they've been focused on immigration issues and stuff like that, but they have to recognize that the Latino community, also here in Georgia, there's a huge amount of it that is very conservative. And the polls that I've seen, the majority of the Latino voters approve maintaining Roe versus Wade, but the rate is basically the same as the white community. And religion plays a huge role in those conservative Latino communities. And it's going to be interesting because it might turn out the vote if it becomes a one-issue election. But at the same time, we may see some Latinos getting reached out by the Republican Party and telling them that, you know, like many did, like even if you don't like some of the things that we've done to the community or how we talked about immigration issues and stuff like that, we are quote unquote pro-life, and that's probably going to turn them to go and get the vote out probably for Republicans. So it's going to be interesting how the voters will react to this campaign shaping as a one issue now.
Yeah, Raphael, I haven't seen the most recent polling on abortion by race and ethnicity, but I have seen studies over the polling over the last few years. And the one thing that I have noticed, and it's not surprising, is that Catholic Hispanics tend to be opposed to abortion. I would think are much more likely to be animated to turn out to vote for a candidate who opposes abortion, given their religious beliefs. Yes?
Yes, and that's why it's going to make things a little interesting when it comes to that, because that's one of the issues that trigger the Hispanic population has been used by Republicans, like when the Cuban protest started, like that's one of the things that Republicans took advantage of to tell them, hey, the Democrats are pro-Castro regime, and so we are the ones who are here fighting communism and stuff like that. So we're probably going to see that strategy moving forward. And like you said, Bill, religion plays such a huge and important role with so many of the Hispanic community here.
Amy, it's not surprising that while Democrats like a Raphael Warnock, like a Stacey Abrams, other Democrats on the ballot are all expressing their passionate concerns about choice being overturned, Republicans are ducking the issue a bit by choosing to focus on how outrageous the leak was. Now, the leak was extraordinary and worthy of condemnation. It just seems to have been a terrible, terrible kind of blow to the integrity of the court. Nevertheless, it's a good way for Republicans to not have to deal with the issue, which is one of the reasons Schumer wants to force a vote next week.
No, it's very true. One of the things that is most interesting about the sort of bills that have been put in place, and it's true about sort of the Georgia bill that, of course, is right now blocked in the federal courts, is that we've seen a lot of sort of restrictive legislation passed in the states, many times with minority support from the public. So it may have passed, right, the one in Georgia passed by a single vote. But in fact, a majority of the population, when asked about the provisions of the bill, are not in support of it. And so there's this disconnect between what it is that the public actually wants to have happen and what a lot of these bills, if this draft decision was to become law, would do. And that becomes sort of the thing that I think for a lot of Republicans that they don't actually want to discuss, right? They don't want to have to answer the questions like Jim had brought up of what happens to, right, the child who is raped and ends up being pregnant. They don't want to answer the question of, more importantly, what happens to the woman who miscarries, goes to the hospital because she's having complications, and now gets questioned about what she did. Is she now liable, even if she wanted, right, to be pregnant? But 40% of all pregnancies end in a miscarriage, right? And also, they don't want to answer the question of what happens to, again, the many, many women, unfortunately, especially in the state of Georgia, who run into complications while they are pregnant. Maternal health, unfortunately, in this country, and particularly in Georgia, is not safe. Women die, right? They want to be pregnant. They run into complications. And under, right, these provisions right now, a lot of these laws, the way that they are written, would say that even if we know that there is an issue and there's something that could be done to aid the woman, that nothing can be done, right? Some laws say there's no exceptions to the health and life of the mother. Other ones say that those exceptions only kick in if, in fact, the woman is basically about to die. So we're not allowed to take preventive health care measures to save the person who was pregnant until it is that she's about to die. She has to get sick. And that's actually the same issue that led to there to be an expansion, right, and an overturning of laws against abortion in Ireland, is that there was a 30-year-old woman who developed complications while pregnant, went to the hospital, they knew what the issues were, and they were prevented from being able to take action until she became incredibly sick and she ended up dying. And so this is what we're sort of forcing, what I think is coming into play, and that I think is also going to play a huge impact on voters who, up until now, this has been simply an abstract conversation of something that could happen.
Chuck and then Jim.
Well, I want to go back to the leak, and I think the word you used, Bill, was egregious. I kind of look at the leak as probably some of the most important reporting I've seen in my lifetime. I mean, that leak resulted from reporting. And, you know, maybe somebody had a source that at Politico that trusted them enough to put literally something that will get them disbarred if they are an attorney in that person's hands. And I may be wrong looking at it, but that when I saw it, my first thought was, how did the reporter get here? That's just an amazing place for a reporter to be, who the Politico people that broke this. That's just my thought on it.
No, I think, Jim, and you weigh in any way you want on this, but I think to the extent that this is journalism at its best, you may condemn the leak, but once Politico had the draft, you have to give them credit for saying, we know it's legitimate, we know it's authentic, we know it will cause one of the biggest controversies the country has seen in years, but it's news.
Right. And I will say a case can be made for the leaker being of any ideological ilk. I can make the argument that it benefits the conservative wing, the dominant conservative wing of the court, and the liberal side. But I wanted to get back to something that Amy was saying, and just to emphasize it. So much of this anti-abortion legislation in Georgia and in other states has been kind of showboating to the GOP base. And it's these measures have been passed with the understanding that a federal judge would step in and halt enforcement, and suddenly that is no longer the case, and Republicans are going to have to actually govern on this issue, and that means these measures are going to have to you're going to have to take a look at what they've put on the books, and to see what needs to be adjusted in the days to come.
All right, Jim Galloway, you get the last word in the first segment of the show. I want to keep talking about this issue and all of the ripple effects, the waves that have just flowed out of the leak, and we'll do that after these messages. Amy Steigerwald, Chuck Williams, Rafael Olivaria, and Jim Galloway continue with me now on Political Rewind. Chuck, one of the things that people are talking about now is looking at the fact that states across the country are going to be a patchwork of pro and anti-choice states, assuming this opinion becomes final. And it looks like we're going to see wars between states. And what's interesting about this is the last time we've had anything that comes close to the potential for this conflict were the fugitive slave laws, in which states were adamantly fighting against one another in what to do about slaves that escaped from their plantations. But it could turn this country even more divided in really, really troubling ways.
You know, you're right. And you, if you watch the 2020 election, the aftermath of it, you were like, this country can't get more divided. There's no way. And then it's like, you know, watch this. And I saw a map of potential states and where they would go. And Georgia is right in the heart of a swath that is pretty much not going to allow abortions. I mean, there it may change a little bit, but if you look, it runs Oklahoma down into Arkansas, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, you know, up in the Carolinas, Florida even right now. So, I mean, it's fascinating to look. I mean, we're, you know, somebody in Georgia's, if they want to have an abortion, they're probably going to have to get on a plane. I mean, pretty much they're going to have to get on a plane and go to a city, you know, a two-hour flight away. And, I mean, that's just, you know, the thing about it, when you take somebody like me, I mean, a lot of older folks are oblivious to the abortion issue because we don't know who's had the abortions because the women who've had them don't talk about it. As you start seeing more women talk about their experiences, and even women that are my age, I'm 61, I mean, you're going to see more women come out and say, I did this when I was in my 20s. And it's going to cause us to have to sit up and look at this differently, in much the same way that the gay rights bill, the gay rights thought process changed when it impacted more people's families. I think we're moving in that direction.
Rafael?
I believe what Todd is saying is very important, and I wanted to share with you something that we thought about at Univision when we were covering the story. I had the opportunity because she wanted to. A Latino activist, she said, you know what, I'm going to share my story. And my story of the day was basically, instead of having like the Planned Parenthood spokesperson and then the Georgia Right to Life spokesperson, so I focused it on her. And she told the story how she had an abortion when she was 19 years old. She talked about how she believes now that it was the right choice for her, how she wasn't ready then, how that turned into job opportunities for her that she wanted, how she was able to feel useful and she didn't want it right now. So she and how important it was for her having her family to love her and accept it when she told them that she was about to do it. So she talked about how she wanted other women to have that same right. And I think it was interesting, you know, exposing that to the Hispanic community, because as Chuck is saying, it's so important to have their voices heard, because more than politics, it's about them, the women, and how their life would change if, as you were talking about, it's completely banned in Georgia, because Georgia Right to Life, they're saying, you know, the heartbeat law is not enough. I mean, if Roe gets overturned, then we will lobby and try to ban it, like straight away, like no exception. So it's important to have their voices heard because their life would completely change, like you were talking about, if they would have to take a plane to try to travel somewhere and try to get an abortion in a different state. Because for many, you know, especially low-income communities, that's not, you know, a very practical option.
By the way, the most chilling cartoon that I think Mike Lukovich has done in a very long time appears in the AJC today. If you get the paper, you ought to look at it. The caption of it, it shows a woman sitting at a desk with a man in a white coat, but the caption is, "Abortion, a decision between a woman and her travel agent." It was chilling to me to see that cartoon from Lukovich. Amy, I want to take up one more aspect of this before we move on to other subjects. And that's, you know, I've said on this show before, I don't think there is a more brilliant analyst of the Supreme Court than Linda Greenhouse, who, of course, was on staff for The New York Times, now writes a biweekly column on the court for The Times. And she published one today that I've put up on my personal Twitter, which is at Nigat B, if you want to read it. But she says something that I never really either realized or thought about. She says that that people think that Roe is some kind of, is her language, some kind of feminist screed about the right to abortion. But Roe was really a decision about the right of doctors to exercise their judgment about a patient's best interest without risking prosecution or and prison. So while she's in some ways being critical of the fact that neither Roe nor the Alito opinion really talk about women in a particularly important way, Alito not at all, is she's also making an important point about how this is an that overturning Roe now would interfere with a doctor's ability to do what's best for his patient. That's a whole different way of looking at it.
Yes, and it's true on both ways, right? So one of the things that was sort of striking about Alito's opinion is that there is, in fact, no discussion, right, of the woman. She is not sort of within it. It is framed sort of really as this right to abortion, as opposed to, for example, the way that O'Connor discusses it in Casey v. Planned Parenthood, about being about the right of the woman to decide whether she wants to bear or beget a child, and putting it more in that. One of the things that people don't realize, right, we've got to put Roe in context. It's 1973. We've got two things going on. Number one, we have the American Medical Association reasserting control over what doctors can do and wanting to ensure that they're going to be protected. Second, we are in a scheme where in 1973, we haven't really had the early equal protection cases yet, right? They've only just started. The idea that there is, in fact, right, this idea of we're going to give heightened scrutiny to distinctions made between the sexes and genders doesn't exist yet, right? That's only barely coming out. In 1973, in a lot of states, women weren't allowed to serve on juries. They could be prevented from doing multiple things. They were not allowed to hold certain positions, right? So they weren't, in fact, sort of viewed in that way. And I think that's part of it. By the time we get to Casey in 1992, we've really seen that shift. We're now after, right, those landmark cases that have said, wait a second, right? No, right? We're going to now recognize in law that you can't, right? Women are allowed to hold these different positions. They can't be blocked from doing these things just because of their gender. And we also see a shift. That's part of what the once we get to Casey, while it is true that there's sort of this question of what exactly is an undue burden, it places it, it now centers the woman to say what's an undue burden on her as she is trying to make these crucial decisions, and it really shifts it to be about an individual right. So I think the other thing that I do just want, the last point I want to make is that one of the things that would be important about this decision that I think is going to then also spill over into the politics, this will be the first time that the court has overruled a precedent and in doing so has taken away an individual right. That is not in fact what happened, right? For example, in Plessy.
Well, and of course, Alito, based on everything you just said, Alito rolls us back to the days of Roe when the rights of women as equals weren't so firmly established in law. Changes in Casey, and now Alito, if that decision as written stands, takes us back to those earlier days. Galloway, before we get a break, that's the one last thing I'd like to ask for your thoughts on. Before we do, and that's now we see the court in the middle of the most intense political storm, perhaps, I don't know when the last time was, it was as intense as this, if ever, because the leak put it out there. The question is, how much do we imagine it's possible that even if the court, continues supporting outlawing Roe, the language in the opinion changes to take into account some of the concerns being expressed by people.
Yeah, this is going to be very interesting to see how the American public digests the sausage making of the Supreme Court. You know, I mean, the Alito leak was very clearly designated as a first draft, and these decisions go through multiple drafts, 5, 6, 7, 8, to get the language just right to satisfy each one. There are internal arguments, and of course, and I'm sure we've talked about that. You've talked about this in previous days. The leak happened kind of days before, only days after the Wall Street Journal published an opinion column in which said that Chief Justice John Roberts was trying to woo the most conservative judges on the bench to adopt a more narrow decision. Yes. When it came to the Mississippi case. And so, yes. So there, yes. there's a possibility that he might succeed. And if that's the case, then we'll have the before and the after snapshot of this decision.
All right. I got to get to a break. Thank you for a terrific conversation of a story that we'll be following, no doubt, for weeks and weeks to come. We'll be back with more on Political Rewind in just a minute. On Monday on Political Rewind, we're going to take one of our semi-regular looks at spending in campaigns in Georgia so far on the latest ads, what messages are being distributed by the campaigns out there. But just very briefly, the Abrams campaign reported just day before yesterday that Abrams has raised $11.7 million in the three-month period between February and April. She has more than $8 million in the bank. Kemp had raised 2.7 in the last days since the legislative session. He's got 10.7 million on hand, so he's well funded. We don't know about Perdue's latest numbers, but we know he lags dramatically behind. All right, so we'll talk about that in much more detail on Monday's show. Raphael, the culture wars, abortion being the biggest one right now, continue to drive much of what's happening in the election this year. And the latest effort by Republicans was to give the Georgia High School Athletic Association the right to decide what to do about how transgendered athletes would compete in sports. And it was no surprise that GHSA voted unanimously that kids could not participate in the gender they identify with, but rather only in the gender which was given to them when they were born. This is a huge cultural battle, but once again, I wonder if where the Latino community is on this issue, being in some ways more conservative, perhaps, than the larger population around.
Yes, you will see a lot more conservatism in the Latino community, and you can see it very similar to the abortion issue, where you have people trying to reach out to their own people in their community. So we had with the abortion issue, we've had also a story with trans Latinx community talking to their own community to try to understand how this may impact kids. And I believe there's something interesting here, Bill, and when it comes to how they apply to this, because I asked the Georgia High School Association about this. You know, they talk about the birth certificate, right? There are, in other countries, such as some state in Mexico, you can change the birth certificate. And are there other states in the U.S. where you can change it? So it gets to a point where I was speaking with other people where if there might be an instance where you will have a birth certificate that you were able to change it and they wouldn't know they changed it, so how they would apply to it. Then they say they want, well, they wanted the certificate at birth. So it's going to probably, when it comes to applying all of this, it's probably going to get a little messy when we come into these gray areas where foreign-born kids and kids being born at different states in the U.S. where they have different regulations.
Chuck?
You know, the Georgia High School Association acted very quickly. I mean, they took it up, and it was a vote of their executive committee, Bill, and that's a fairly large committee. It's 40. It's not like you would think a board of 8, 10, 12, 15 people. This is 40.
I think it's like 60 people. Okay.
Yeah,
go ahead.
It's a large committee that is representative throughout the state. So when we were looking at it last night just to see who the Columbus Chattahoochee Valley representatives were. And, you know, the quickness, I don't think the Georgia High School Association wanted this dumped in their lap, but they certainly dealt with it very quickly when it was. And, you know, and that association, as we've discussed before on this show, has a tremendous amount of authority over public high schools in the state of Georgia. And so, you know, is a lot, you know, two questions, and I don't have the answers to them. Somebody does, I'm sure. How many athletes are we talking about? How many athletes are we actually talking about? First question. The second question is, will any of those athletes, if there are any, file suit?
Yeah, I think we've got –
go ahead, Jim, and then Amy.
Okay. No. First of all, I don't think anybody has been able to point to any example of a transgender student participating on an athletic team in Georgia. But I think what we have to understand is kind of the political dynamics here. Okay. This was a very, very bitter fight in the legislature. The move to put it to the GHSA was a kind of a duck and cover thing. You were trying to shift it to another entity and create a study committee at the same time to kind of put the issue in cold storage. That was a general election strategy backed by House Speaker David Ralston, who does not want to see that issue come up and bite his members in a November general election where his people are vulnerable. But what we saw happen with the GHSA was a primary dynamic, I think. That was something that I think that was passed to protect Brian Kemp in his primary against David Perdue to prevent David Perdue from having that opening.
Fascinating. Amy?
No, I think that is right. And I think one of the things that is also coming out of this, that I think even those who might have voted in favor of this amendment, is that it was supposed to be that there was first this study committee. And in fact, the speaker afterwards said that he wanted it. And the GPB reporting is that he said he was going to tell, right, the Georgia High School Association that he didn't want transgender children, quote unquote, targeted, that he wanted them to look at it, right, especially in concert with the mental health bill that was just passed. And so I think what is going to be interesting to see is how this plays out, and also what are the implications, right, of doing this, especially given some new executive orders that have been passed that relate to Title IX. This would seem to be in opposition to that. And so I think if there are transgender children who are planning on doing it, right, they are going to have a possibility to be able to challenge this under federal law. And so we should probably look for that to potentially occur.
So, Chuck, how you're in an interesting part of the state down there. So let me turn to that for a few minutes if I can. Number one, you're down there with the second district. You've got this interesting race shaping up in Sanford Bishop's district, which has become a little bit more Republican. So there's that going on right now. And just the other day, you traveled across the state line just a little ways to go to Troy to see Joe Biden, make a visit over there. Talk to us a little bit about what's happening down in your corner of the state right now.
President Biden was in Pike County, Alabama. There is a Lockheed Martin missile plant. I did not know that they're making Javelin missiles in rural Alabama. It's tucked off of 231, 25 miles from Montgomery, 20 miles from Troy. And they're making about 5,000 to 6,000 Javelins a year. They also make other missiles and other weapons systems, but the Javelin is, because of its use in the Ukraine war right now, is high profile. And that's why President Biden came down there. It was fascinating because you look at the workers, and I'm from Alabama. I understand Alabama politics a little bit, enough to think I understand it. And I saw that room, and they had about 200 of the Lockheed Martin employees in that room. And if I had to guess, there may have been 25 Biden votes in there, maybe.
Well, that's what I thought was interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. You can't tell a book by the cover, but you got a pretty good idea what you're reading when you look at it. And, it was, except Bluestein's book. Bluestein's book is that way, but, it's just fascinating to go in that room because President Biden came in and he was introduced by this woman named Linda Griffin, and she was 60-ish African-American woman, and she was outstanding in her support of President Biden, and she was a perfect prop for him.
I would love, okay, a couple things. We are really running out of time. So a couple things, Chuck. Number one, I was really interested in hearing you make the point about Biden making that visit. I get the Javelin missile is important in the country right now, but it's an interesting place for a guy whose approval ratings are so low. He's not going to win a whole lot of votes there. We will talk about Sanford Bishop in the 2nd District at some point on the show in the weeks ahead, Chuck. We're not going to be able to get to it now because we are out of time for today's Political Rewind. So Chuck Williams of WRBL-TV, we always love having you on the show. Amy Steigerwald, thank you for your insights, particularly about what's happening with the opinion on Roe. Jim Galloway, love having you with us on Fridays. And Rafael Olivaria, you need to come back. We want to have you on more often. We need Univision represented on Political Rewind. So thank you, too, for being here today. So that's it. We are out of time for Political Rewind. Oh, one quick note. Guess who's coming on the show Tuesday, Jim Galloway? Cynthia Tucker, the legendary columnist from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, has a brand new book. We're really excited about talking with Cynthia about that. That's it for us. Thank you very much, Sam Burmes-Dawes, Jay Cook, Natalie Mendenhall, Jesse Neiswanger, Sarah Callis, for all the work you do to get this show up and running every single day. Thank you all for listening. Back again on Monday. In the meantime, please take care. Stay healthy. Bye, everybody.